Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 29, Tolkien and Rowling, What the Wizarding World Owes to Middle-Earth, part 2, where we will continue our conversation with Sara Brown and Amy Sturgis about the connections and divergences between these two series, their fandoms, and the movie adaptations. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert guest is Dean of Harry Potter Scholars, John Granger, author of the Deathly Hallows Lectures. We are picking up where we left off in our last episode on Tolkien and Rowling, and we turn once again to our guest, Dr. Sara Brown, an English teacher at Rydal Penrose School in North Wales and a professor at Signum University since 2012, and Dr. Amy Sturgis, faculty at Lenore Ryan University, staff at the Hugo Award-winning podcast Starship Sofa, and editor-in-chief of Hocus Pocus Comics. We left off talking about the benefits of putting these two authors in conversation with each other, and now we'll continue our discussion with the way the fandom itself overlaps, or doesn't.
Ourselves. That Tolkien is the man who sets up the bulkhead, the barrier, the point of resistance to all those things, and that Rowling stands atop that barrier is why we should bother looking for Tolkien's influence on Rowling.
One of the things that you've mentioned here, John, is attractions that people have to these stories. We have given good reason for people to be drawn to both the Tolkien saga and the Wizarding World books, you know, at the same time. And yet, there is not as much overlap in those two fandoms as you might expect. So let's turn to talking a little bit about the fandoms and the readership of the two, and how does this reflect some differences in the ways that people are reading these books, and why isn't there more fan overlap?
I'm going to jump in here because I want to speak for Harry Potter fandom, which they will probably find very disappointing, and just give the typical Harry Potter fan view of the Tolkien fandom.
Sure.
And then let the experts correct these misconceptions. the Harry Potter fandom has always felt like the poor young stepchild in fandoms, because the Tolkienites from the beginning have shown little outside of the present company, a little bit disdain for Harry Potter as a world building, as you know, its depth, its width, its height, and that I've always thought that was kind of a reaction of the Tolkienites having suffered such condescension and being patronized by academics for decades. They felt it was finally their turn to look down their noses at this new kid on the block. So that's just the non-Tolkienites view of the two fandoms. I trust Amy and Sara will correct that.
If I may?
Please do.
Okay. I hate to disagree with John, but I'm going to disagree with John. But very gently. I mean, obviously, I can't speak to the perspective that you have, because if you have that perspective, it's clearly come from somewhere. But the thing is, the Tolkien fandom is way more complex than you might think, because it's not one great amorphous body. For a start, I would split the Tolkien fandom into the book fans and the film fans. There is some crossover between the two, like me, for example. But if you're looking at fandom and the way in which they were producing transformative works, for example, fan fiction, etc., there was quite the rivalry between the we are book Tolkien fans and we write book Tolkien fan fiction, and we are film Tolkien fans and we write film Tolkien fan fiction. And you could often see this in very simple things, like whether Frodo's eyes were blue or brown, for example, would tell you straight away as to whether we have a book fan or a film fan in the first sentence. And the rivalry between the two fandoms was actually quite extraordinary and at times quite vitriolic, because some of the book pre-film fans felt that the film fans were newcomers treading on their toes, and that we were here first and we are better than this, et cetera, et cetera. Now, hashtag not all fans, obviously. So there's been a lot of, shall we say, grumpy dynamics within the Tolkien fandom, mm-hmm. anyway. I also think that there's a lot of crossovers between those who are Tolkien fans and those who are Harry Potter fans, perhaps more than perhaps you're aware of. I have seen some snobbery in the Tolkien fandom regarding the Harry Potter fandom. But again, that also depends on what element of it we are talking about. The Harry Potter shipping wars, for example, were viewed with some derision amongst some elements of the Tolkien fandom and with amusement by others. Whereas there were shipping wars within the Tolkien fandom too. So I think the problem lies with painting the entire Tolkien fandom with one enormous amorphous brush, because there's a vast and wide and deep fandom there. And there are many of us who absolutely adore Harry Potter as well. If your perception is that the Tolkien fandom have perceived the Harry Potter fandom generally with derision, well, you know, I apologize on behalf of all Tolkien fans. I'm fairly sure a large bunch of us would never intend that. But yeah, the Tolkien fandom is not a whole body, is what I would like to leave that comment with.
What's fascinating to me, what Sarah says, is that about this division between a book fandom and a film fandom, is that certainly the same division exists now within Harry Potter fandom.
Absolutely.
Those of maybe we'll talk about this later. I'm obviously the book snob fandom within Harry Potter, but it's fascinating, as you, Sarah, because as I said, looking out from the Harry Potter thing, most of what you get is the kind of dismissive thing from the Uber, the Michael O'Brien perspective on Harry Potter from the Tolkienite perspective, that this is nothing of this. There's no connection here.
Amy, you know, you are somebody who I think immediately went into the Harry Potter fandom, having been in the Tolkien fandom for a long time too. And I am inclined to see Sarah's point that I think there are a lot of people who love Tolkien, and then when Harry Potter came along, they were like on board with that. Would you agree with that? What do you think?
I do agree with that. That has been my personal experience, but I also online seeing how both fandoms are reacting to, you know, similar stresses and similar points of agreement. I see it quite a lot of crossover. If I may make a intensely self-interested little personal plug here, I've written several works about the fan community, and one of them speaks directly to what Sarah was saying. It's called Make Mine Movieverse: How the Tolkien Fan Fiction Community Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Peter Jackson. And that's in the book Tolkien on Film. But it's about something that both of the fandoms have dealt with and are dealing with, and that's negotiating the points where texts collide, where the films and books don't meet or contradict each other, or, you know, the stage play changes contexts, or a new adaptation adds different material or overturns past assumptions or even canon, and how they reconcile those things, what they discard, how they critique it. All of these things are similar in both fandoms and fascinating to see, as fans are so creative in what they do. And the fandoms are both dealing with similar things. Intergenerational fans, global fans coming from different cultural contexts, fans with different, this, I can't emphasize this enough, fans with different points of entry into the series. People who came to it from the books, from the movies, from video games. People who come to it from a costuming angle, and that's how they fell in love. They fell in love with still shots of costumes, and that's how they got into the universe to begin with. And these fans have different interests, different emphases, different assumptions about parent texts. And personally, I go to a lot of science fiction conventions, and I see a lot of crossover between the people who will go to a Tolkien panel and who will go to a Harry Potter panel. And I will, in terms of fan creativity, I've read fan fiction where the hobbits get sorted into their Hogwarts houses. There's crossover, literally crossover there. And, you know, there are differences, of course, and I think one of them is about the fact that you can literally grow up with the characters in Harry Potter. And even though The Hobbit was originally created for children, it still has adult characters in it. There's no, it's still a hero's journey, but it's not a coming of age story. And so I think people attach in different ways, perhaps because some people, as you know, I didn't. I was a full grown adult when I came to Harry Potter, but some people had the experience of literally growing up with Harry, and that mm-hmm. may be a different kind of connection. In the 1960s, Time magazine said that going to college without Tolkien is like going without sneakers. And the same might have been true in the 90s or the 2000s for middle schoolers and Harry Potter, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that points of connectivity are much stronger than the points of contention or any rifts or schisms between the two. Like I said, fan events, fan panels, fan conventions, collectors. I've been asked to speak about Harry Potter at Tolkien-centered conventions. I've been asked to speak about Tolkien at Harry Potter events. And again, you know, the literal crossover in fan creativity is quite strong when you see people mashing up the two. What house would Galadriel have been in, right? It's there's what would be your ideal Hogwarts faculty taken from the leaders of Middle Earth? You know, it's there's a lot of crossover there.
Gandalf, obviously.
So and he doesn't even have to change his outfit.
Like, not Galadriel. That's way too intense for a faculty member. Okay. You have reminded me, though, that I'm sort of thinking back on a lot of the Harry Potter conferences that I've gone to, and I mostly go to academic conferences, and many times there will be some thorny issue, and some wise person in the audience will stand up and say, you know, you all should really look at how the Tolkien people have dealt with this issue, because we can actually learn from each other's, not just fan communities, but the ACA fan communities as well. And we can draw from that. So I appreciate what you said. I'm also really interested in Sarah and Amy. You both talked a little bit about this. I think that there are some generational changes coming, right? The fandoms are not just staying static. But especially as you had the movies come in and it's changed some elements of the Lord of the Rings fandom. And then you've got the Fantastic Beasts that changes some of the aspects of the Rowling fandom. And then you've got people who, you know, I think you call them Generation Hex, John, who had to wait for the books, you know, who are growing up along with the characters, as you mentioned, Amy. And we don't necessarily have that anymore because, I mean, most kids, I would guess, if they're like my son, you read the one and then you blow through all seven, you know, and then you can reread. So you're not, you know, you're not, he's not waiting until he's 17 to read the last book in Harry Potter. And so as a result, you get these changes in the fan fiction communities that might be kind of mixing things up. And maybe, I mean, I would hope that there would be ever more connection in our Venn diagram, more overlap. Now, one of the things to link back to a comment, Amy, that you had made about the limitations of Tolkien and Rowling, fan communities are a way to explore those, right? So fans are looking for, and Sarah, you know, you communicated some about this, and a chance to live in these wonderful worlds that have been created. And then they also, through their fan communities, are critiquing or even reinventing the fantasy worlds. And maybe, Sarah, I don't know if you want to start us off. What's your feeling about, you know, the nature of fan communities and the criticism, particularly maybe of Tolkien?
One of the beauties of fan fiction is that it gives fans the opportunity to write into the gaps. So creating new extra scenes, things like that, it gives them the chance to rewrite what they don't like. I think the Sherlock fandom went through that quite extensively post the last series. And it does give them the chance to engage with the characters in very different ways. In terms of critiquing Tolkien, I'm not sure that I have seen that within fan fiction so much. I've seen a lot of interesting stuff done with fan fiction. There's a heck of a lot of slash out there within the Tolkien fan fiction, as I know that there is in the Harry Potter fan world. Yeah, a heck of a lot. And until you've read Legolas and Gimli slash, you haven't lived.
Oh my.
Indeed. But I think that where it comes to critiquing it, I'm not sure I'm seeing that within the way that the fandom are writing fan fiction. I don't know, Amy, if you would disagree with that.
Well, I've done some work on, for example, the way I did a piece just looking at Rosie Cotton fan fiction, for example, that was in Mythlore, and looking at the way that fan fiction writers who are writing and reimagining and giving new roles to Rosie Cotton were kind of speaking back to a lack of agency in the female characters perceived in Tolkien's works. And one that immediately comes to mind, one of the stories basically had Rosie say when Samwise returns, "I was having my own adventures while you were gone." And then the story that was told was the whole backstory of what she had been doing for Middle Earth while he was away. And I think there's a degree of critique implied in some of these works saying, while Tolkien was looking over here, we can create some agency for characters over here. And I think that there's a lot of love there, but it's a loving critique. So I'd say that I've seen some. I've gone looking for it, but it's definitely, definitely there. But again, it depends on what kind of fiction you're looking at. And I've seen, in terms of other fan creations also, ways of creating different kinds of characters, different diversity, inclusion for more kinds of characters from fans who feel like they're really not represented but want to be in Middle-earth.
And I think that you do see something similar in the Harry Potter fandom. You've got Harry Potter told if Harry Potter was Indian, for example. And then I also was thinking about the play, the off-Broadway play Puffs, which I was able to see just on Amazon Prime this summer. And it is retelling the 7-book Harry Potter series from the vantage point of nameless Hufflepuffs. They get names in there, but they're not people who J.K. Rowling ever named. And it's doing something really similar to what you were talking about with Rosie Cotton, Amy. I hadn't thought about that before, but it's like, while all of this is happening center stage, there are, you know, other people who are affected by this, and you have ignored them. And so I'm going to show you what these Hufflepuffs were doing the whole time and, you know, how they experienced Cedric Diggory's rise and fall and all of that. And so so I think there is some implicit critique that goes on when you're filling in some of those gaps.
So I just wanted to agree with what you're saying there. And I think it was what I was trying quite clumsily to say when I was mentioning writing into the gaps, because fan fiction writers do that. They see gaps. They see characters that haven't had their story. They see moments that haven't been explored the way they want them to see explored. They see elements of the story that they would like to see from a different perspective. And fan writers write into those gaps. And in doing that, they expand the world enormously, which I think is one of the wonderful things about the fan transformative works.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there is more, since J.K. Rowling is still around and still producing and tweeting and things like that, then she has, I think, some vulnerabilities to, especially with the Fantastic Beasts series and some of the missteps she's had there. You know, I think there's maybe a different level of, like, criticism of the author that maybe comes through the Harry Potter fan community. Although, maybe, I don't know, do you see a lot of criticism of Tolkien himself coming from the fan community?
I think there's always going to be an engagement with the question of racism mm-hmm. with Tolkien, mm-hmm. Because that is a really interesting subject, and it's very current. In fact, Dimitra Femi has not long published a very interesting essay on entitled, as far as I can remember, Was Tolkien Racist? And engaging with the way in which he is presenting race within his work. And I think that there is implicit in some of the writing, there is implicit criticism of the way in which certain races are depicted within the story. And it's also in fan discussions quite a lot, because it is actually an important discussion. As to whether Tolkien is racist or not, I think we can agree that, yes, to a large extent, he was indeed racist as we see it from our 21st century perspective. From his perspective, it wouldn't have been part of the way in which he was thinking. But it's difficult to get away from it when you look at the way in which he describes the Southrons, the way in which he presents the orcs, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fan engagement with questions like that, and absolutely with the idea of his presentation of women. When I first started writing my thesis, and I was telling people that one of the things I was going to be doing was looking at Tolkien from a feminist perspective, I wish I'd had a pound for every time someone said, but there aren't any female characters, which, one, wrong, and two, doesn't mean you can't read it from a feminist perspective.
Right.
But it all comes down to what extent you believe these female characters have agency. And again, I'm seeing increasing amounts of engagement with that. Tolkien and sexuality is another element that's being written about quite extensively now. Queering Tolkien, in fact, there will be a book coming out next year, which I'm hopefully being published in, which is talking about queering Tolkien's work. There's all sorts of things that fans are engaging with that I think are in-depth, interesting, and extremely current.
Yeah, and those are all the same kinds of areas in which Rowling is catching critique, too. So that's another really interesting intersection that I think is valuable to, you know, to use to reflect each other. Now, Amy, you've been doing some work on fan immersive experiences. The Long Expected Party and Hogstown School for Witchcraft and Wizardry. That's Hoggstowne. I love that. Hogstown School for Witchcraft and Wizardry. You know, why do fans engage in these immersive experiences? And what is that allowing them to do as they become part of these fantasy worlds?
I think it goes back to something that I think everyone here has already mentioned, and it's the idea of world building. The world building of both of these authors is so impressive, so compelling, that people want to be there. Sara was saying, you know, she could just immediately see herself in Hogwarts. And I think part of that, of course, is there's an entertainment issue. There's the desire to escape to someplace that's better. You know, when the world looks like a dumpster fire, wouldn't it be nice to go here? But I think really, to a much greater degree, it's about people who want to sort of cultivate the parts of themselves that would thrive there, the best parts of themselves, and then take those things back to the so-called real world. So the two you mentioned, the Long Expected Party and Hogstown School for Witchcraft and Wizardry, that's another example, by the way, these two, of where these fandoms intersect, because a lot of people have been involved with both. But for example, these are events that have taken place where fans come from all over the world. It takes place in Kentucky in the United States, but there are people there from all the way from New Zealand and everywhere else. And fans rent out the Shaker Village of Pleasant Hill, which is this amazing destination, 3,000 acres of the best preserved 19th century buildings in private hands. This originally a Kentucky Shaker settlement. And they, in both of these cases, they utterly transformed this 3,000 acres. So for instance, at the Long Expected Party, there are dinners every evening outside that are meant to be sort of communal. And each night, it's a different race from Middle Earth. So it might be an elvish night one night and a dwarf night the next night. But then it culminates in a recreation of Bilbo's birthday party. And everyone is in costume. And you get up in the morning and you're walking across the countryside and there's a bunch of hobbits walking around. And there is a combination of inviting scholars to come and speak. The medievalist Michael Drought has been one of those. I've been there. There have been others, but also creators, professional artists, people who've been involved with the films. So it's both a book verse and a movie verse kind of experience. But really what it's about, there are competitions, you know, archery and these kinds of things. People get together and cook. They make things. It's remarkable. They do things that are creative and that produce good things and share them with each other. And it's an immersive 4-day experience. And I think why people do that in large part is because while you're there, first of all, you're getting to share things you love with each other. And yes, John, some people do speak to each other in Elvish the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
But also they're, it's this experience where people are trust each other, right? They are not locking their doors or carrying their bags around for, you know, to be sure that no one steals their stuff. It's this place where they feel at home because they've read and seen films about these places, and now they can experience the positivity of being involved with found family and kind of recharge their batteries. Again, this goes back to Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, the importance of having this experience of stepping away from your life and seeing things through new eyes and essentially recharging your spiritual batteries. And I think both universes speak the same way to people, that they would like to be there. They would like to be more the kind of people who would be there and have tolerance and have mercy and have love for each other and feel like they're going to fight the good fight, however they define what the good fight is, and that they're worthy to be people who would go on a quest or who would fight the dark powers, right? And this sort of shared loved things held in common, it's a lot about the world we're in today and how people want to have those gifts that these texts provide, taking them back out into the world today. And like I said, I've seen quite a lot of crossover between the people who take part in things like this. And the level of creativity is amazing. The music that's written and performed, the artists who create the backdrops to transform an old Shaker barn into, you know, the Mines of Moria or into the Great Hall at Hogwarts. They have a choir that sings, made up of participants who practice during the days and then perform at night when everyone eats together. It's just this remarkable sense of community. And I'm just so fascinated and inspired by the kind of creativity that fans come together to do and create and make and have these conversations with each other. And I think there is a level of critique because there are ways in which, you know, the little skits done, for example, can speak back to the authors. I'm thinking of one that gender swapped all of the main characters, for example, intentionally. And said that, you know, when Gandalf and Radagast and Saruman, when the Istari were sent down to go interact with, you know, with Middle Earth, the so-called wizards, they were all women. And when they had to, when they realized they were going to have to take on some kind of disguise, they all just clipped on these little beards and said, we're ready to go. And it was this, it was a very funny little skit, but it was also suggesting that, you know, that in this case, the stories that we hear and think of actually had women behind them, you know, so they're speaking back to the texts, but it's also reimagining and recreating and reinventing. And most of all, just taking part in and drawing strength and energy from these stories.
There's something really inspiring about that. Something lovely about the idea that you had this phrase, loved things held in common, that can draw people together in community. And that's just one of those deeply humanistic things that I think resonates with both the Tolkien series and Rowling's series as well. Well, let's talk about, as our final question here, another way that these stories became reality for more and more fans, the movie adaptations. All right, who did the better job, Sara and Amy? I can tell you're not really angry at Peter Jackson, the earlier things that you said. John, I know you're not absolutely a fan of movie adaptation. I'm understating again. But when we look at these adaptations, who do we think did a better job? And, you know, how do we see the movies themselves changing the way that people come to these stories?
All right, let's talk about the Tolkien films, the Jackson films. The Lord of the Rings films I loved. I had one or two minor issues. I could have done without skateboarding elves, for example, and I wasn't too sure about the moment where Frodo sent Sam back on Cirith Ungol. That didn't work for me, but other than that, I thought they were amazing. I absolutely loved them. I thought they were a really well done adaptation, but the Hobbit films. Oh boy. The Hobbit films were the biggest letdown for me. I was delighted when I heard that Peter Jackson was going to be doing them because I felt that we would get consistency of vision, that the world of Middle Earth that he would create within The Hobbit would be recognizably like the world of Middle Earth that he created for The Lord of the Rings very successfully, I thought. But here's the massive problem. He did one film per book for The Lord of the Rings, and it worked. And then he takes The Hobbit, which is shorter than any of those three individual books, and he turns them into three films. The result for me was an absolute miasma of pain. There were one or two scenes that I enjoyed. My favourite scene of all three was Riddles in the Dark, which I thought was really well done, which apparently was the very first scene that was filmed. However, for the rest of it, I thought it was a hot mess. My poor husband, who took me to see the third film because I just felt, no, I've got to see it, I'm going to have to see it, he said it was like having evil tinnitus because I'm sitting in the back row, hands gripping the seat arms, constantly muttering into his ear about, well, that's not right, and this is awful, and what on earth are they doing, and where did those worms come from? So, yeah, it's a mixed bag for me because the Hobbit films were not great. In fact, they were less than great. I thought they were dreadful. So that's a bit of a shame because for me, Jackson had done a really good job with the first three films. They weren't perfect. I would love in another 10 years or so to see a new adaptation again of those films because I think there's still room for more. And of course, we've got the new Amazon series that's coming along very soon, which will be really interesting. And I'm very happy to see some of the academics that are being taken on board with that. So, you know, with Tom Shippey on board, I'm feeling pretty comfortable. But hoo boy, the Hobbit films. I'm just going to leave it there.
Amy, what do you think? What are your thoughts?
Sarah said it beautifully. I would say, I think my whole experience with adaptations is partly mediated by the fact that I was very much into fandom pretty much all of my life. And so I was reading fan fiction avidly as an early teenager and ever since then. And I've sort of learned how to, first of all, just get over it. And secondly, to appreciate that I can grab things and make them part of my headcanon when I love them, and then just completely reject other things. So, for example, I fully agree about what you said about The Hobbit, Sarah, but yet Martin Freeman as a young Ian Holm, both as Bilbo, are genius. And I'm perfectly happy to keep them in my heads, like I have more than one. I have one on the desk right now, sitting looking at me. No, I'm both of them in my head as, you know, placekeepers when I think about Bilbo Baggins, because I think they're wonderful. And then I can, you know, sort of ignore what I don't like the abomination that was the casting of Michael Gambon as Dumbledore. Okay, maybe I don't completely ignore it. Maybe I keep holding on to it. But I think, you know, there are differences, one being that The Lord of the Rings had already been made before, mm-hmm. and it'll be made again. As Sarah's pointed out, they're already the expectation that these will be done and redone and redone. And Tolkien hasn't had a say in any of them, whereas Rowling mm-hmm. had a say in her films. And even now that her storytelling has sort of moved from text to film and telling directly through film, she still has a connection there, a very strong connection. I would love to see remakes of the Harry Potter series and all in the future. And I think that would be a very healthy thing. I actually think the Harry Potter films ended on a far stronger footing than Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings film started at the highest note with Fellowship, which was the one that was most closely wed to the text, and it fell apart from there on. It fell apart in a beautiful way, and I still watch all three films, but I think the third one is not nearly as strong as the first, in part because Jackson started adding his own stuff to it. And I think the Harry Potter films ended on one of the highest notes of the whole film series, beautifully realized. So in a sense, the learning curve there seemed to work in opposite trajectories. But I'm very happy to always have Alan Rickman in my head as Snape and grumble consistently about Michael Gambon, and that's not going to affect, you know, the way I connect to the books. But I really do hope that neither of these film series is the last word, and I think we've already got indications that they won't be. I'd love to see what other people do to it, and then I'll either adopt it or I'll reject it.
And I do think it's, you know, you sort of think, well, the film versions might supplant the books, right? People are watching the films instead of reading the books. And I'm sure that happens in some cases. But my guess is that the people who are only watching the movies and not getting into the books, I don't think they were going to get into the books anyway.
I agree 100%.
My theory. And what I hope happens more often than not is that having seen the movie, then you give the books a try and you realize that they're wonderful treasures that are even more wonderful than the films themselves.
But the book experience after the film experience is not the book experience.
You think that that if you've seen the films, it somehow has tarnished your ability to get what you need to get out of the books?
No, it hasn't tarnished it. It's destroyed it. I mean, really, really, to be very clear, that books are an imaginative experience that, again, back to the pre-moderns, this is a faculty of the human person, which is very distinct than sense perception and the ability to put together a narrative from sense perception, sitting in a theater, watching a film, hearing the soundtrack. All of those images displace any creative capacity in the human being. You can't see Clark Gable as Rhett Butler and then read Gone with the Wind and experience the book imaginatively. You're only going to see Clark Gable. And I defy, I mean, Rowling says that she doesn't see Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter in her own mind. And that's, again, in the file of things only true of J.K. Rowling. Mm. So that the imaginative experience is destroyed by the sense perception experience in film. It's really an age is defined by its core beliefs on epistemology, anthropology, psychology, and those are reflected in their art. And we live in an age of materialists, materialist understanding of all of those things, so that all of our knowledge is based is drawn from sense perception, and so our art is predominantly film. If poetry has essentially disappeared from the public sphere, which is almost exclusively of that imaginative faculty, that world has gone and been displaced. The world of poetry has been displaced by film, and it's a much darker world. And I think it's a world that are being critiqued implicitly by the Tolkien and Rowling narratives, and that Christopher Tolkien's objections to the films, his horror really at the film adaptations, and Rowling's rejection of movie adaptations of her work, that she's running the screenplays herself, or she's controlling entirely the film productions of the Cormoran Strike books in a studio that she owns, reflects her disdain for the film studios and their adaptations. Really, that there is a fandom that is book fandom and film fandom. Those people may cross over, people that I admire and I like the present company, but we have to understand that these are entirely different experiences that have an entirely different dimension of effect and transformation on those who go into them. The films have almost zero transformative effect. People walk out of them only confirmed in the prejudices that they come out with because they're of the worldview that the books are built to destroy or to attack. These are entirely different dimensions. I'm sorry to be the old grumpy man here.
I was going to say you sound like what we said about Tolkien. You know, that you're looking at what's lost, and you know you're mourning what's lost, and that have a similar hope about what might be coming.
In my thesis, I'm doing a lot of reading now on William Blake, and certainly his ideas about the imagination and what's been lost, in terms of songs of innocence and songs of experience, really illumines for me the tragedy of film as a medium, in that it may reach certain people that couldn't be reached because their imaginative faculty has atrophied to the point where they can't create these stories themselves internally. But it has, for those people who can, it has short-circuited or diminished that capacity significantly.
I don't think you're giving imagination enough credit, to be honest, John. I don't see how, if people have imprinted on the films, they can turn around and write some of these amazing fan fiction stories that imagine Harry Potter gender-swapped. Or that say, what if we recast the Lord of the Rings in our minds and then spin off from that? What would it have been like if you had a completely different cast, say a cast of all actors who are people of color? What if Riz Ahmed, which is one I saw, was Frodo? And I thought, oh, wow, headcanon accepted. If people couldn't imagine these sorts of things, if they were locked and loaded into that one position that they, I appreciate that where you have your entry point into a fandom, does start out your assumptions, does give you certain emphases and certain assumptions to begin with. But then as you grow in the different texts and explore, I don't think it demolishes that opportunity to imagine, or you wouldn't have the kinds of fan fiction I've seen, or for that matter, if watching a film were such a passive experience, you wouldn't have films then inspiring people to do things that really alter what the films originally intended to do. If that just imprinted on imagination, people wouldn't speak back to films or try to reimagine things differently or take the story on to the next point. I think the imagination is a lot more dynamic and robust than maybe you might be given it credit for.
again, the word imagination, as you're using it, is strictly about a capacity to create story. And what I'm talking about in imagination is, again, a faculty within the human person that enters into the story and has an alchemical experience inside of it, is transformed. Certainly, one of the laudable things about Harry Potter is or Tolkien fandoms is that you see the expression in song with Wizard Rock and other things, and everything from cosplay to this and that. But I'd assert that as a rule, these fandoms are strictly within the meta narratives of the age and don't challenge it. It's just the predominance of slash fiction, for instance, is something that is you would call that an imaginative adaptation of this. Well, I would just call it a perversion and an assault on the tenets and the point of what these books are really about to advance the predominant meta narrative of our age, be it sexual license or whatever. And that, or category busting, that there can't be any good meta narratives, even except for that meta narrative. You know, all meta narratives are bad except for this meta narrative. That, you know, I don't think I'm understanding imagination. I'm talking about imagination in terms of primary and secondary imagination as Coleridge defines them, and that's probably a little outside the scope of this podcast. But seriously, the films, because they reduce the experience to something which is prepackaged, while inspiring perhaps, you know, an outflow of dialogue so much as that experience contrasts with what people believe in as their core beliefs, which differs from the pre-modern and postmodern attack on modernity. I'm not impressed.
All right, listeners, you will have your chance to say what you think about the, you know, the movie adaptations and whether we think they are doing irreparable harm to the ability of those of us who engage with the text then to be transformed by them. I think that's a really interesting conversation, and I think some of what we conclude will depend on where we stand in the beginning of that. So, very interesting conversation. I basically will do anything that allows me to experience these worlds again. So I'm always happy to have more. And I think a lot of fans typically feel that way too, but maybe it's not good for us. I'll leave it there for listeners, you to decide. Well, we are at the end of our podcasting time, and this has been such an amazing conversation. I was just thinking about all the topics that we covered and all of the really amazing insights that I have gained from listening to all of your conversations. So I really appreciate that. I want to say a particular thank you to Dr. Sarah Brown. Sarah, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and helping us to compare Tolkien and Rowling to see their confluences and divergences.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
It's been such an exciting conversation. Thank you also to Dr. Amy Sturgis for coming back to our show for our Tolkien conversation.
This has been a delight. I'm just honored to have been a part of this. Thank you.
And a special thank you to our continuing expert guest, John, film curmudgeon though he may be. thank you always for your insights as well.
You're very kind to keep inviting me.
A big thank you to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma, thanks for everything that you do for us. We could not do this without you. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and Laurie Beckoff, our MuggleNet liaison and producer. Speaking of which, dear listeners, we are so glad you joined us today. We would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or through our Facebook page. And now, listeners, I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.